Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Double X is brought to you by MeUndies. MeUndies makes the world's most comfortable underwear in a variety of styles and patterns. Head to MeUndies.com/XX to get free shipping and 20% off your first order. And by Blue Apron. For less than $10 a meal, Blue Apron delivers right to your door everything you need to create a home-cooked meal. Perfectly portioned farm-fresh ingredients come with an easy-to-follow recipe card, so you can create a delicious dinner in 40 minutes or less. Visit blueapron.com/XX to get your first two meals free. And by Smith & Noble, offering custom window treatments including blinds, shutters, shades and panels without the custom price. For a limited time, get 25% off your window coverings, plus a free in-home consultation when you visit smithandnoble.com/XX or call 1-800-659-3300.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gabfest for Thursday, April 7th, the We Just Want Attention edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a host of NPR's Invisibilia in D.C., and I'm joined in the New York studios by June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog, and freshly back from Japan. Hi, June.
Hey, Hannah.
We missed you.
Well, thank you.
We really missed you, and our listeners really missed you.
Aw, thank you, listeners.
So welcome back.
Thanks.
Sure. And Noreen Malone of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi, Hannah. I got nothing.
You got
been
nothing.
Here.
Freshly back from Brooklyn, always.
Yeah.
And forever. Before we get started, I have a couple of things to say. One is that, so in our last show, we called 90s feminism a dead space. And a listener, Jason Gillespie, wrote in to say, Riot Girls, you idiots. We forgot about the Riot Girls. So sorry about that. That was a stupid mistake.
It was a stupid mistake, but in our defense, the Riot Girls were like a countercultural small movement, and we were talking about big mass culture moments, I would say.
That's true. You're stepping in by saying they were a small movement, but the fact that they were countercultural movement maybe just proves our point, is what you're saying. It's like the big, broad culture was a feminist dead space, and so that kind of created a counterculture space for the Riot Girls, but still, you know. Could have been a small mention. And my next announcement is that we need a new intern. It's time for us to find a new intern. The wonderful Shiva Bayat is ready to join the real working world. And so, as all interns should and are. So please, if you're interested in becoming a XX Gabfest intern, we need you to be in New York or D.C. available for tapings on Wednesdays. Please send an email to XXGabfest@slate.com and put in the subject line, intern. We would love to hear from you. Okay, let's get started with our show today. Our first topic is Girls and Sex, a new book by Peggy Orenstein about the sex lives of young women. Second, the gender-neutral pronoun. We seem to be forming a consensus around they, which is grammatically incorrect, but fair, maybe. We will discuss. And finally, the latest sexist insult, she just wants attention. Our first topic is girls and sex. In her new book, Peggy Orenstein interviews 70 young women between the ages of 15 and 20, and very few of them seem to be having fun. They're having sex, they're comfortable with sex, they talk about it a lot, but they don't seem to connect it much with pleasure. And they say things like, if he's having fun, I'm having fun. So we talked to Peggy to find out about this new landscape. So, Peggy, I have one question for you, which is what me and my friends have talked about, because you are everywhere, by the way. Like, I do not run into anyone who hasn't, like, heard an interview with you or read a review. Congratulations on that. That's awesome.
Thank you. Kind of crazy, isn't it?
It's great. It's great. It means that, like, it means that people want to talk about this. The one thing that comes up with me and my friends is that, like, there is the pleasure thing, does it read different between for the 13-year-olds and the 19-year-olds? Like, I feel like at some level there's a conversation to be had with slightly older teenagers and, you know, grown women. And then there's a whole other conversation
Are you saying that you shouldn't mention that to your 13-year-old?
I don't know. I'm trying to decide, like, what the conversation about pleasure looks like for a 13 to 18-year-old and what it looks like for a later kid.
Ideally, you would be talking in some aspect to your kid all the way along. I mean, like, preschoolers masturbate like crazy. I mean, I don't know if you remember that from having a preschooler, but, you know, it's you can
from being a preschooler. You
know, yeah. Well, I don't remember being a preschooler, but, you can say to your preschooler, it feels really good when you touch your vulva, but, you know, it's something that we do in private and not in grandma's living room at a family gathering, you know?
Right.
I don't think that a discussion about sexual pleasure necessarily has to be the discussion you would have with an adult when you're talking to a child, but an awareness of the mechanisms of pleasure, for instance, you know, the existence of your clitoris and that it's there to make good feelings. That's something that you can learn in puberty education class. Just, you know, even that much. That if you're diagramming that not just diagramming the internal part in puberty ed class, but also diagramming the outside of the female genitalia and knowing the correct names. I mean, there's a story exactly like that in the book, right at the very end, where I'm sitting in a sex ed class for fourth and fifth graders, a co-ed class, and these two boys are sitting there, and one of them says they're diagramming, and one of them leans over the other one and says, "What's this again?" And the other one says, "That's the clitoris. It's for making good feelings." And I thought, I want my daughter to date that boy, you know?
Right.
And it's just like, just knowing, you know, starting to know what the parts are, starting to know, you know, rights and entitlement, I think is totally legitimate to talk about with your 13-year-old. I mean, you don't have to get into even telling a 13-year-old an orgasm is a perfectly legit thing. You don't have to be necessarily buying her a vibrator.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Peggy, since you just mentioned that sex ed class that you attended, the thing that most struck me about this book, the thing that outraged me, was just learning, in my case for the first time, about just the absolute untruths that are often told in official, as it were, you know, in schools, in sex ed classes, or in whatever they choose to call it. Maybe perhaps that term is considered too risky.
I know, that would be like an Orwellian term for them, right?
Right. And, I mean...
Yeah. What do you mean, June? Like what, for example?
Well, Peggy documents all kinds of just absolutely erroneous facts, the things that are presented as facts that, you know, perfectly normal things lead to...
That HPV...
Like that all gay boys have HIV already and that it can be passed along through tears.
Right.
Or that one in every four condoms has a hole in it. Only 23 states mandate sex ed at all, and only 13 mandate that it be medically accurate. And there was a federal investigation into the abstinence-only curricula that just found that they were riddled with outright lies and misinformation. And even, you know, in California, where one of the states where it has to be medically accurate, and it wasn't until like last summer that the city of Clovis was found in violation because they were having kids watch a movie that said that an unmarried woman who has sex is like a dirty old shoe, and they were having them chant anti-gay slogans. So, you know, sex ed, calling that sex ed is really a misnomer.
Peggy, one thing that's different, though, than when all of us were in school is that kids can presumably take to the internet and do some of their own detective work. I wonder if you think that's on balance a good thing or a more complicated thing.
I think it's more complicated. I mean, I've asked sex educators and people who do research on youth about how kids use the internet to look for sexual information, and I would love to say that they go to sites like Scarlet Teen or Go Ask Alice, and they do some, and those are great, and those are really fabulous sites, or Dan Savage, or, you know, something like that, but a lot of times they just kind of Google blowjob, and what you get is not really what you'd want your child to be learning from. You end up with a lot of porn, and in that New York Times piece that I wrote, I cited a British survey of college students that said 60% of them consult porn in part as sex ed, which, you know, is not really where you want your kid learning about what sex is and what its values are, since it's really there for the gratification of men and to get eyeballs.
The lack of pleasure principle that you describe is what I found most alarming in the book and most alarming in general about porn and the culture out there for women specifically. And could you talk about that a little bit, how women talked about pleasure and sexual pleasure and what their relationship with it was?
Yeah, actually, you know, the first couple interviews that I did, I really blew, because in part because I kept saying, like, what about you? What about you? What about you? You know, and the girls, at those, the first two girls I talked to actually never spoke to me again. I often followed up with girls, and some of them after a while I developed, you know, relationships with, and we would correspond, and I would bounce ideas in the book off them to make sure that, you know, that I was on track, or that if they felt something wasn't authentic. But the first two girls, I texted, I emailed, I Facebooked, nothing. And I asked one of their friends, who I was, one friend of one of them, who I was also interested in, who I also interviewed, and she said, you asked her about sexual pleasure. Girls do not want to talk about that. And, you know, it's statistically, it's really interesting to look at the research, because we always think that when we're talking about things like pleasure and satisfaction, that we're talking about the same thing. But with sexual satisfaction, girls are more likely than young women, college-age women, are more likely than young men to say, to measure their satisfaction by their partner's pleasure. So to say, if he's satisfied, I'm satisfied. And young men are more likely to measure their satisfaction by their own pleasure. So to say, if I had an orgasm, I'm satisfied. So everybody's measuring it by, in a heterosexual relationship, by the guy's pleasure.
And but one thing that I kept thinking about, and Anne Friedman wrote about on The Cut, actually, is that maybe this isn't actually so new. You're noticing it, you're documenting it in this generation, and there are obviously specific things that are happening now that change it in all kinds of different ways. But this is, you know, a decade, centuries, millennia old thing.
Yes. Yeah. I loved Anne Friedman's piece. I thought it was fabulous. And I guess, you know, my question was not just, you know, is this new, but why hasn't it changed? Mm-hmm. When, you know, when girls are so much more empowered in the classroom, so much more empowered in their ideas of ambition, in their professional lives, they're so, you know, they've found voice, they're more politically effective, they're organizing around assault, they're doing all these things. Why is this the one place, you know, they're leaning in over there all over the place, and over here they're toppling over? Why hasn't more changed? And, you know, is that on us, on our generation, for not having better communicated with them what we hoped for them in these relationships?
I mean, I know that you qualify, you know, a lot of statements like that in the book. And I do think, for example, that the, you know, as you just mentioned, the, all the focus on sexual assault. I mean, in the last few years, we have seen this huge focus on women on college campuses protesting sexual assault and rape. And you know, I know when it first started, I was like, you know, I went to college with a lot of drinking. There wasn't that much. And I'm realized over, you know, over time that my response was actually about, oh, maybe they're just being much more aware, much more assertive. They're, you know, they're standing up. So that in a sense, that's one change. And maybe that's a sign of things that we just at first treat as, oh, this is happening more, is actually that people are standing up, then that there are some changes happening when it comes to girls and sex.
Yeah, I think that that's likely true. And what I really wanted to look at was what happens after yes, you know, because I felt like consent is super, you know, that whole movement and consent is fantastic, super important, but consent is such a low bar for a sexual experience, you know, like I was not raped, you know, that's a really low bar. And so what happens after yes? What, how are, you know, some of the things that the dynamics going on perhaps feeding into the prevalence of assault, whether you're talking about today or whether you're talking about 20 or 30 years ago? And also, I really became aware, and this was partly because of the assault conversation, but also because I was going around even before that when I was talking about my previous book, Cinderella Ate My Daughter, and there was some, you know, discussion in that book about these ideas about sex and about pleasure and about differentiating between sexualization and sexuality. And I would talk about that in my discussions with parents and talk about the idea that girls had, you know, a right to sexual agency and entitlement. And they would say, yeah. But what about those STDs? And I thought, there's this weird way that we're almost more comfortable as a culture talking about girls as victims of sexuality rather than agents of sexuality.
Yeah.
Peggy, I was so struck by the phrase catching feelings that came up in your book. So I was in college like a decade ago, right? And so this landscape actually did not seem that different. Certainly the conversation around consent and assault is different than when I was in college, but the general sort of, you know, hookup culture, alcohol.
Yeah. You had the internet.
We had the internet. Yeah, it that didn't seem so different. But I thought you did a really smart job of explaining why kids get so drunk in college in order to hook up. And I wondered if you could just talk about that a little bit here.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it's 89% of hookups that are with somebody that you don't know, and over 70% when you do in some fashion know the person are conducted drunk. And drunk, and it's not just that alcohol lubricates. I mean, you know, there's also always been a, like, let's have a drink first, sort of relax, but that hookup culture is kind of dependent on alcohol, and that it's necessary for what Lisa Wade, who is at Occidental College, calls compulsory carelessness. And kids, when she reported that kids would talk about sober sex like it was sort of an amazing unicorn that never happened. Because in order not to care, in order to do that, you have to be pretty wasted.
Right. It's like a prophylactic against feelings is drinking. So you don't catch your feelings.
That's what they would talk about. That's a very nice way of putting it. So they would talk. I mean, I'm such a word nerd, and I was always struck by language. The language the kids used that was different than language that used to be used. And even, you know, like that whole idea of talking, we're talking, you know, and I think, oh, you're talking. But we would have said, we're seeing somebody, although that's just as weird, you know, to say, I'm seeing someone. What is that? You know, but it would seem particularly ironic since they never actually spoke. They were always texting at each other. But one of the phrases was catching feelings, and they talked about it. It was like a disease. Like, I caught gonorrhea, I caught herpes, oh, I caught feelings. You know, it was actually caring about your sexual partner. So, yeah, it was really interesting.
But, and yet, the kids who seem to have the best experiences in your book were the ones who actually, you know, had some sort of feelings for their partner. It's like it's the scariest thing when you're 21 or even 31 to like be vulnerable in that way, and I think that's just what people haven't figured out how to do yet, and that's why they, you know, you do a bunch of shots before you go out in college.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear you say that, because I've been getting a lot of feedback from women in their mid-20s lately saying, write about us, you know, what happens when you've been in that hookup culture since high school and suddenly you start thinking you want to, you know, start having relationships, but you've never had one. You know, how do you make that transition? What do you do? How do we do this? And I don't know if I'm going to do that or not, but it sort of surprises me, I guess, because, you know, I didn't feel like it was my place to say hookup's good, hookup's bad, relationship's good, relationship's bad. You know, that's not my role. But what I did want people, young people to understand is what you're likely and not likely to get out of a hookup. So that you can sort of think about that. Like, you know, the sex isn't going to be really great, probably. Not likely. The rates of orgasm for women, for instance, in hookups are way lower, partly because you have to be able to communicate better and all of that, but also because among heterosexuals, straight men typically just don't care about their partners as much during the hookup. So they don't care. You know, one guy just said, you know, I don't give a shit about a partner in a hookup. Can I say that on radio?
You can say it.
Yeah.
This is why every form of sex ed in America should include scenes from the first season of Girls, when Hannah Horvath realized that she needs to claim her pleasure when having sex. And that was the greatest contribution.
Or we should all become Dutch. I like how you wrote about the Dutch woman. Okay. Well, Peggy, congratulations on your book. Congratulations on being everywhere. Again, it's Girls and Sex. You should check it out, whether you have daughters, whether you want to learn about the culture. It's just as relevant for 20-year-olds, 30-year-olds. I think actually for anyone in just thinking and talking about female pleasure and the state of the culture on this question right now. Peggy, thank you so much for joining us.
You guys are great. Thanks so much.
Sure.
So this week, the XX GabFest is sponsored by MeUndies. Whether you're wearing a suit or sweats, you spend 24 hours a day in your underwear. Well, not 24, but still. Instead of making a statement, your underwear is probably, well, boring. But MeUndies is here to change that. Every pair of MeUndies is made from sustainably sourced modal. That's a fabric that's twice as soft as cotton. Nothing can describe the feel and fit of MeUndies, but once you try them on, you'll understand why they're called the world's most comfortable underwear. And if you don't love your first pair of MeUndies, they're free, no questions asked. MeUndies has dozens of styles and limited edition prints to help you make a statement with your underwear, whether anyone can see them or not. Shipping is free in the US and Canada, and you can save up to $8 a pair with the MeUndies subscription plan. Get the subscription or a single pair and get 20% off your first order when you go to MeUndies.com/XX. That's MeUndies.com/XX for 20% off your first order.
All right, let's move on to our second topic, the gender-neutral pronoun. We seem to have a leading contender for the gender-neutral pronoun, the grammatically incorrect, bland, and totally useful they, as in, I think we're going to have to explain, like, how you use they, because we all know how you use they, but I had trouble, like, I really had to practice a little bit in figuring out how to use it.
Is here for lunch, is what you would say for a person who has chosen to be identified as gender neutral rather than they are here for lunch.
The New York Times, when the Washington Post decided they were going to use they as their gender neutral pronoun, which they did, they didn't mean they is here for lunch. They meant at the other end of the sentence, like everyone hates their fourth grade English teacher who made them diagram sentences. It's like, as opposed to everyone hates his or her English teacher.
That's not the exclusive use. That's one use, but that's not the exclusive use. They also were talking about people who did not want to use he or she.
Yeah. That's what I thought was the revolutionary thing. And the difficult thing, right? Because you just said they also decided, and I was like, wait, is she talking about a person or is she talking about the Washington Post? And you were talking about the Washington Post. So this is the problem that grammar people have with it,
right?
Is that it's sort of confusing and unspecific and rewriting this very, you know, deep-seated idea about subject-verb agreement.
Right.
Well, do you use are or is? Like, they is coming. If somebody doesn't...
singular.
So I was thinking it was more like the examples they gave were like a doctor listens to their patients, because that's technically grammatically incorrect. It should be a doctor listens to his or her patients, which nobody wants to write ever.
I think the reason that this movement is happening, which does extend to the sort of more sloppy grammatical use, but the reason it's happening is because there are all these people who feel like the binary pronoun he or she does not describe them, and they're looking for something else, and there are all kinds of options. I wrote down some of them, many of which I can't even pronounce because they're sort of weird. Z-E, which I guess you say Z. A-E-Y-A-H-I-R, here, X-E. So there are all these sort of, you know, things that could be more grammatically easy to use because they wouldn't make our ears explode in the way that they is does. But they also have their own problems because they're weird words that no one's going to remember.
There are two categories of this. There's one for people who don't want to be described in the gender binary. But I also thought it was to get rid of this reflexive and, you know, I've thought sexist since maybe I was like 4 years old, use of he as the default pronoun. That you just use he, you know, or his in a default way. No one wants to write his or hers. And or you have to make the kind of fake choice of using hers sprinkled throughout.
Yeah, I think that also is something that some people have talked about, but I don't think that's why it's particularly in the news. I mean, Amanda Hess had a piece in the New York Times Magazine that definitely addressed that and talked about how, you know, there's been a study that showed that when teachers, for example, emphasize a gender gap in speech, so they say, hello, girls and boys, or as the teachers used to say in my school, because I went to school with the Romans, salve puli pulaque. That, which of course
Wait,
you,
what?
Which of
you saw, hello, girls and boys in Latin.
Yeah,
and we salvete. Would say,
salve. And
can you say that again?
Salve puli pulaque, and we would say et tu quoque salve. But
that's awesome.
But when the teacher does emphasize that there are girls and boys, then children adopt more intense stereotypes about what girls and boys are supposed to do.
I believe that. That's Jill Soloway has said that a lot. I believe that. I think that's absolutely must be true, that in classes, you know, teachers will reflexively say girls this, boys this, when there's really no reason for it. You know, there's no reason to divide people into girls and boys when you're talking about a math class or a gym class or whatever.
Yeah. And so I think that there are definitely attempts to avoid that needless gendering. But then there is also the question of a gender neutral pronoun, which I think a lot of people, and the reason that it's come up is that there is a discussion that you have as a person, as, you know, when you have friends who request that you use particular pronouns, that it is, you know, a no-brainer. Of course, you follow their wishes. That's perfectly, I mean, it doesn't even seem like there would be any discussion of that. But it is a little trickier at a publication because you, for example, as a writer, I don't necessarily want to have to ask everybody what their preferred pronouns are. Now, if I was in a room in a social situation, I wouldn't complain about that. But as a writer, oh, God, man, that's a lot of extra work.
It is. But even if, you know, you have a friend who tells you, I don't want to be, I don't want to be identified as a girl anymore. Refer to me as they. Even if you are fully on board there, it's just hard to remember.
Right,
it really is. I have a friend whose sister now wants to be identified as they, and my friend was describing this transition, and she, even when she, my friend was like telling us all about it and telling us how much she wanted to support her sibling, she couldn't stop, you know, toggling back between she and they. It just doesn't, like, we aren't trained yet. So even if you are the most supportive possible person in the world, it's so hard to retrain yourself.
Yeah.
But I think it's kind of cool. I don't know. I'm super interested in language, and it's crazy that the English language only has two pronouns, really. It kind of is, you know, the Eskimos have however many words for snow, and in the 21st century, identity is so complicated and the language is catching up, and it's, for people who are interested in words, it's kind of fun to watch.
Yeah, I definitely think we're in this transitional period. Like, I mean, it is awful. I've been so, felt so bad about accidentally using the wrong pronouns when I truly didn't want to. I really wasn't making, you know, except possibly on some deep psychological level, which I don't want to accept. But it is still a challenge. There was a really funny piece in the Washington Post about a woman who, in order, I think, to try to become more used to using preferred pronouns, chose to make her cats gender neutral and to use the pronoun they with them in a singular way.
It was a pretty great internet headline. It was something like, don't laugh, but I'm raising my cats gender neutral, which of course she wants you to laugh at that.
Right.
But it was actually really instructive, actually, as a way of going through the world and realizing how difficult it was and how people would be like, you know, confused. And I mean, she had, I think, a pretty corollary experience to what you guys are describing your friends are having.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the they, I mean, they is the gender neutral pronoun in that sense. I don't feel like it's silly to invent a new word for a new specific category. Like, I like the use of they in place of his or her because that's natural and we do that anyway in English. But why can't we, since this category is pretty specific and applies to relatively fewer people, why can't you just have a new, like, that one, that they serves the purpose of just deconstructing the gender binary in our language in general, which is long overdue, but that the Z or Zim serves the purpose of identifying a new class of people, because they, to describe a singular person, is weird.
I just think Z or Zim is no more weird, and it feels to me like then we're imposing something on a group of people who have had enough imposition.
Yeah. And
but I thought those words come from them. Doesn't it come from the queer community?
Yeah. I mean, it's not like, but each person has a different preference.
Right.
And I would definitely prefer to have, yeah, maybe it is an imposition, but again, I, as a person in a social setting, I'm very happy and very committed to asking what people prefer. But in a writing, I don't want to have to. I mean, it's just laziness.
Well, but I even feel it's philosophically unsettling to describe a single person as they, because it's almost like conceding that their identity is sort of confused and unresolved, like they're two different people instead of this new singular entity that we have to get our heads around that is neither he nor she, but not both he and she, unless maybe it is both.
I think it just means I am a person. And mm-hmm. I, the interesting thing within this movement is that it's like a million flowers blooming. There are so many different identities that people are feeling describe them. And so then you would get into the subtleties of what is Zay versus Z, and that becomes complicated in a totally different way. Whereas they is sort of big tent. I'm a human. You're a human. Maybe I'll explain the way I identify to you, but I don't have to. Maybe. So
you just don't think about it too much. It's I'm part of the human race. Don't think too much about what it specifically means.
I think
just neither he nor she.
That's my understanding. I would love to have people write in and tell us, who are much closer to this, tell us, what their understanding is. But one thing, as someone who just identifies as she, simple, it does seem like almost rude to ask someone, what is your preferred pronoun? If someone asked me that, I might be taken aback. And maybe, that's because I present as pretty female, right? But it does seem pretty invasive to ask someone to assume, like, maybe this will become the default in the future. But right now, it's not the default to ask someone, what's your preferred pronoun? And you're sort of asking, in some ways, a very private question, almost. I don't know. Am I crazy, June?
Well, June, you write about queer stuff more than the rest of us and edit. Does it ever come up? Like, has someone ever complained to you, oh, you used the wrong pronoun, or please refer to me as this, or don't refer to me as that? Like, does that come up in everyday editing?
I mean, not everyday editing, but certainly it's something that we're very aware of. And again, although it's kind of almost, I feel bad to admit that I was resistant, that and really quite recently had a piece that said, they prefer to use the pronoun they. And I'm not going to pretend that there isn't, again, as an editor, not as a human, but as an editor, as a writer, some resistance to, like, oh my goodness, every single, this is going to add a complication to my job. But when it did come up in a real life situation rather than in a theoretical, oh, what is our general policy on this? It felt really wrong to say, no, you can't be. You have to be. And then what would you be? Which bag that you reject am I going to force you into? It's like it's playing a role that we would decry in pretty much any situation. So it became impossible to say, no, you can't be they. And so, yeah, it feels like a thing where we talk a lot and we can get into these philosophical, discussions. But when it comes down to it, it's really, can you say to someone, to a person, no, I'm sorry, I'm going to call you something that you really don't want to be called. Like, that's really not something that I think most reasonable people feel comfortable doing.
Uh-huh. Fair. Okay, so I guess that what we're saying here is that we're going to get more and more used to it. I mean, it'll just come up in situations. People will ask for it. It'll show up in Slate and in New York Magazine and the New York Times and your local newspaper. And eventually we'll just see it enough times that it won't seem so jarring to read the sentence, they is.
And I think we are definitely in a period of transition where everything seems really strange and crazy and outrageous, and it really isn't. Like, we all agree that gender is changing and pronouns are really the least of it. So You know, why are we dividing classes? I remember when I was in school, we sat, it was a mixed school, and the girls sat separately from the boys when we were, you know, put into positions. Like, what is that about? Why on earth were we doing that? And I think these questions of pronouns make us think about things like that, but they're actually pretty easy.
Okay. Anyway, readers, please write in with your they stories. We're very curious how this gets enacted in day-to-day life, whether you've ever asked to be referred to as they, if anyone's ever asked you and what you've thought about it. We would really love to hear your stories on our Facebook page, or you can email us, xxgabfest@slate.com. Okay, let's move on to our third topic. But before we do that, let's thank our sponsor.
This week, the XX Gabfest is also sponsored by Blue Apron. You need to know how to cook, not only because you need to know your way around a kitchen, but because cooking at home means eating healthier and saving money instead of ordering expensive takeout once again. But where do you start? Blue Apron has you covered. For less than $10 a meal, Blue Apron delivers all the fresh ingredients you need to create home-cooked meals. Just follow the easy step-by-step instructions. Each meal can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. No overwhelming trips to the grocery store. No more sad takeout. No matter your dietary preferences, Blue Apron makes it a breeze to discover and prepare dishes like Nepalese chicken tarkari and spinach with jasmine rice, barbecue salmon with mashed sweet potatoes and pear mostarda, or mushroom and spinach enchiladas rojos, right in your own kitchen. And recipes are between 500 to 700 calories a portion. Delicious and good for you. Right now, you can get your first 2 weeks for free at blueapron.com/XX. That's blueapron.com/XX. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Okay, let's move on to our third topic, the latest sexist insult. She just wants attention. It was said about Michelle Fields, the reporter who was grabbed by a Trump aide. It's said about women who claim they were raped, girls who post too much on Instagram, that they want the wrong kind of attention. I'm just going to read a line from a story by Rebecca Onion in Slate this week. She says, in the past couple of years, the attention-seeking label has become an all-purpose way to gaslight feminists, silence those who demand restitution for a specific wrong, and shame women for the way they present their bodies and selves in public. Okay, she just wants attention. Have you guys ever thought about this phrase, or do you think about this phrase as specifically aimed at women?
You know, I hadn't before, and this piece from Rebecca Onion I thought was so brilliant, and it, like, put this thing into focus that I just had never realized before. But yeah, now that I think about it, it's totally gendered.
Totally.
Because you never say, you wouldn't say about Trump, even though he clearly just wants attention and is a narcissist at some level, you wouldn't say he just wants attention. You would use a different set of descriptors for him.
Yeah, you would say it about a little boy, I think, you know, a little boy who's acting out, but you would not say it about an adult man. You just wouldn't. Mm-hmm. And yeah, Trump definitely wants attention. Jesus, like no one.
Yeah, exactly. But no one would say he's doing this because he wants attention. Mm-hmm. So what is the underlying sexism? What is it that we are, you know, what is it we're not allowing women to do when we say that they just want attention?
I think we
speak, show themselves. What is it that they can't do?
I think it's about assertiveness. I think that there's a line that people can cross after which some people will say, oh, now you're just seeking attention. And it's a way of ignoring the thing that they're bringing up. It's a way of putting them down, of essentially taking the attention away from the claim that they're making and turning the conversation around back to some flaw in them, some perceived flaw in them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it's also always putting you in, I'm going to sound really women's studies here, you're stuck in sort of the object category, right? Because if you can't put yourself into the spotlight, you can be in the spotlight, but only if other people put you there. If someone else says, oh, right, she's really smart, she's really pretty, she's really whatever, you should pay attention to her, then you're sort of, other people are looking at you because someone else asked them to, not because you asked them to.
Right, right. And I guess this is what shows up in studies all the time. Like when somebody surveyed women who run for office, almost always they say, well, somebody else, you know, somebody suggested I run for office, or someone put me forward, that's just a thing women have to do. Or all that research about how women are allowed to advocate for other people in the workplace. They can be sort of team playerish, but they can't purely be self-starters. Like that violates some fundamental notion we have of how women should behave. So is the idea that they can be loud, but only so loud, and only and not about themselves? Like, is that the limit we're putting on women?
I think
can you seek attention in the wrong and right ways, I'm asking? Like, is there some way that a woman could put herself forward for attention that's acceptable and other ways that are less acceptable?
I mean, to me, this question is about when you apply that label and are you doing it appropriately or are you doing it to denigrate her, to shut her up? I mean, to show myself in a bad light, I was thinking, okay, have I ever thought of someone as being an attention seeker? And I have to admit that I have thought it, and it's generally about people perhaps whose assertiveness makes me uncomfortable because, for example...
People or women?
Women.
Yeah.
People. Yeah, I call them people when I don't want to admit it.
And is it assertiveness in demanding a cause for themselves, like, say, a lawsuit or restitution or, you know, where they're asking for some kind of recognition for being wronged or for themselves or what kind of thing?
I think in my own life, it's been people more willing to label things as problematic, to say that's not cool. Because, you know, for example, I guess the times when I've particularly thought it of people, it's like, you know, there's some people who things always happen to them. And I was trying to figure out, like, do more things happen to them? Are they making it up? Are they just seeking attention? Like, no, actually, that's possible. There is a category. There is a sort of psychological category of people who, you know, do have a sort of a personality disorder that involves attention seeking. But I think that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about indiscriminately diagnosing strangers or people of our acquaintance who just stand up for themselves. Mm-hmm. And who...
But could you think of men in the drama queen category? That's so interesting what you said about a psych. Because when you said that psych, I can totally recognize the psychological category of person who needs attention. Can you put any men in your life in that category? Drama, emotional drama, you know, putting themselves at the center of grand emotional plays.
I mean, I don't think of it in the same way. I mean, I don't really socialize with that many men, but it's also...
Junior the best.
It is really gendered. I mean,
where I think it's really crystallized right now is if you look at social media. So the Instagram economy is such that, you know, you get likes and they make you feel good. Everyone in some way is looking for attention if they post to Instagram or Facebook, like on a basic level, you can't get around that. Yeah. If a woman puts a photo up of herself, she'll probably get a whole lot more likes than if she put up a photo of her cat, even her gender neutral cat. But then people also label her thirsty, which mm-hmm. is the kind of the ultimate insult of our time, which is another way of saying attention seeking, mm-hmm. like
right,
super
right.
thirsty. And it's like, you know, damned if you do, damned if you don't kind of thing. Because
yeah, because that's the state of being female.
Yeah.
Everything. Did you guys hear that This American Life episode about the 13-year-old girls who posted, you're so pretty, you're so pretty, you're so pretty, and how they post and they like their friends are right, you're so pretty, like 500 times.
No.
And there's just, it's just like a 10-minute clip from a few weeks ago. I think the show is called Social Status, but it's an amazing interview with these 13-year-old girls about their Instagram economy. And it entirely involves sort of posting just the right photo. You never say someone's sexy, but just 100 people pile on in a very short amount of time and just say like, you're so pretty, you're so pretty, you're so pretty. And you wonder, like, and then they keep talking about it. And it's exactly what you say, Noreen. Like, there's a point at which they move from, you know, pretty and popular to thirsty and desperate. Mm-hmm. And they understand that. Like, they talk about other people in those terms. And it has to do with, like, what the picture looks like or how many times you post or what you say about it or what you post on someone else's picture. But it is definitely a line you can cross from, like, you're just posting a picture of yourself, which everyone does, to you're seeking attention.
Yeah. It does seem like it's probably always been this thing, an insult, but it does seem like it's heightened by A, social media, and B, this weird thing where we all spend so much time talking about empowerment, right? And part of empowerment is asking to mm-hmm. have attention on you, and then it's sort of whiplash, right? So you're, on the one hand, these girls or women or anyone is saying, I'm really empowered. I'm going to go into that meeting and talk, or I'm going to put this really pretty photo up of me. And then you're just kind of, you're coming up against this other really, really deep social norm that just seems immovable.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, in the Rebecca Onion piece, she mentions the Ayesha Curry, wife of the basketball player, as opposed to Kim Kardashian. Now, this is not a thing I knew about, I have to admit, but there's like an acceptable way to seek attention, which is Ayesha's way, which is like as the wife, as the good person,
as the cook, even if she's making these wonderful meals for my family.
Exactly. That's like, and she, you know, has a reality show, and like she's attention seeking, but she's not attention seeking in any way that triggers any of the negative sides of attention seeking the way Kim Kardashian is.
Right.
Well, right. I think the appearance thing complicates it. If you're just seeking attention for your appearance, that seems to be where people feel most comfortable criticizing in that way. Although maybe not the sort of reason that Rebecca wrote this piece was this. Young woman Kalani posted an Instagram photo sort of saying that she had attempted suicide, and she was accused of being attention seeking for that, and that, you know, has nothing to do with her appearance. So I guess I'm wrong.
Right. I think it's appearance and also emotional drama are the two categories in which women are called attention seeking in the wrong ways.
Yeah.
Well, one day we will figure out exactly the right number of pictures you're allowed to post on your Instagram and exactly which ones, so that you'll be just the right amount of attention seeking, right?
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Come on our Facebook page. Give us some attention. Tell us all about it.
Okay. Well, let's move on to our recommendations. But before we do that, let's hear from our last sponsor.
The XX Gab Fest is also sponsored by Smith & Noble. The space you live in affects the way you feel. It's important that you're happy with the look and feel of your home. My recommendation? Start by updating your window treatments with Smith & Noble. Smith & Noble's beautiful handcrafted blinds, drapes, shades, and shutters are custom-made just for you, and they offer different service options to fit your needs. Work one-on-one with an expert designer with their in-home design services, or take advantage of their free measuring and low-cost installation services to guarantee a perfect fit for your window treatments. Or, if you decide to do it yourself, they have online and phone support. Create a space that you'll love. Get started today. Contact Smith & Noble to get this special, limited-time offer, 25% off on your window treatments, plus free design consultation. So for details about our special offer, go to smithandnoble.com/XX or call 1-800-659-3300. Again, that's smithandnoble.com/XX.
Okay, recommendations. June, freshly from Japan, why don't you go first?
Well, of course, my recommendation is for Kakimori, a fantastic stationery store in the Kurumai district of Tokyo. No, not really. Although that is a fantastic store. But so I was away for a little more than 3 weeks and I did not watch a second of television. And so, of course, when I came back, I had a lot of catching up to do. And even though I know that you guys did an entire segment on the portrayal of Marcia Clark in the fantastic FX series, The People vs. OJ, I have to say that's the most amazing thing that I've seen in my catch-up is Sarah Paulson's portrayal of Marcia Clark in that show. And in fact, the whole show, which I absolutely love.
I do too. And I am holding back on the last episode.
Me too.
I'm going to watch it tonight. I'm very excited. Okay. So I go next. I am going to recommend, I really hesitate about this because Gate Lees has been such a dick this week, saying that no women inspired him when he was writing and that women don't write about dark subjects, which is really stupid because Joan Didion, at the exact same time he was writing, wrote about very dark subjects and murders in California, among many other people. Anyway, but Thy Neighbor's Wife is one of my favorite books ever, and his book about the sexual revolution. And I realized deep in my soul that I've been waiting. We talk so much about sex 2016, what it looks like, how it's changed, how porn influences it, as we did in today's show. And I realized that deep in my heart, I've been waiting for Gay Talese to weigh in. And he did in the story in The New Yorker, The Voyeur's Motel, which I just think is fantastic about this guy who got a motel so he could cut holes in the ceiling and spy on people, which is nuts. but the story is fantastic. I really, really enjoyed it. So that's my recommendation for the week.
I'm so glad you pivoted at the end because I was about to say, Hannah, you've recommended Thy Neighbor's Wife before.
No. I just I love reading Gage Lee's on sex, and so anyway, I just this
but
is
not
a long
gender,
fantastic. But no, that was just dumb, you know. So yeah, not on gender. Okay, I'm not excusing him. I'm just saying this is a great piece
I get
in
it.
The New Yorker.
I get it. I'll read it.
You get what I'm. You get the fine line I'm walking here. Yeah. Okay. All right, Noreen.
I'm going to recommend a movie with so much male energy, it's insane. I saw Everybody Wants Some, which is the new Richard Linklater movie. It's kind of a follow-up to Dazed and Confused. It's about a baseball team that's either explicitly or implicitly the University of Texas baseball team. And it's just so fun and charming. It's just college boys just kind of being competitive and trying to get laid, and it sounds so dumb and maybe like you wouldn't like it, but you'll love it, I promise. I could not have enjoyed that movie more. So
I'm so glad, because I love Dazed and Confused so much, but the reviews of this were like, it's nostalgic, he's too distant from college, it doesn't have that same raw and real energy that Dazed and Confused has.
It's definitely nostalgic, but in a good way. I think it like gets at young man brain in a way that young man brain has not changed and probably will never change, and the specifics are 1980 whatever. It's kind of fun to see everyone's clothes. Yeah, made me want to buy those jeans.
Awesome road trip for Double X to buy 80s jeans. Well, thanks to our producer, Anne Hepperman. The executive producer of Slate Podcast is Steve Lickteig. Andy Bowers, chief content officer of the Panoply Network. And our intern is Shiva Bayat. Again, we are looking for a new intern. So if you're interested, please email us at xxgabfest@slate.com and put intern in the tagline. Our show page is slate.com/xx. Go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/xxgabfest. And please tell us what you'd like us to talk about and also your experiences with the word they for this week. Or you can email us at xxgabfest@slate.com or subscribe on iTunes or any place else where you get podcasts. For June and Noreen, I'm Hannah Rosen, and we will see you in 2 weeks.